First order of business, everything is screwed up. I guess we have to at least try and figure out what's going on. This section is special for two reasons. First of all, it's a four-week section. It started last week. Of course, the reason it's a four-week section is next week is spring break. There is no class next week. And we missed last Thursday because it snowed. I suspect that we are not going to make it up. I think I mentioned once before, I printed out everybody's schedule and mashed them all together, and the only free time we have is, assuming people haven't dropped classes since the beginning of the semester, is 7:30 in the evening on Wednesday and 5:30 on Friday. Both of those are out. So we have no free time, or no one has a large enough block of free time to make up the class on Thursday that we missed on Thursday. So my suspicion is we're just going to let it float by. So that takes care of the makeup for missing last Thursday. Do we have another class to make up to? Did we miss another class due to snow? Wow, we're not going to make it. Oh, that's right. That's right. School was closed on Wednesday. I remember you were all pissed off because you didn't have classes on Wednesday. And then they held. Then they opened up school at 4:30 on Thursday. Yeah, I remember that. I remember that. And we did actually have class that day. So my guess is we're not going to make up the Thursday class, although I may do something else, who knows, just as a something that is, you're not required to attend. All right, so that takes care of the – and if anybody's upset about that, let me know, because I suspect that I am now officially in trouble because I am actually supposed to make that day up. So if anybody's really upset about – you mean you paid for it and you certainly deserve it, let me know and we'll try and think of something. All right, so that's that. So the point is we have 4 weeks, and this is spring break. Your second programming assignment is out. I was going to talk about your second programming assignment today, but it turns out that someone pointed out to me that I forgot to update it, and so I apologize for that. It is now, in fact, available on both on the schedule and on the assignment directory, so everything's available now. That's due on the 23rd of March. On the 16th of March, your midterm grades are due. So that means that your midterm grades for this class, anyway, will consist of two grades, quiz one and programming assignment one. So you just add those together, divide by two, that's your midterm grade, and then turn it into a letter. That's your midterm grade. Drop day is, I believe, it's on the schedule, so we should check and make sure. But drop day is the 29th of March. Does that make sense? If this is, no, that doesn't make sense, because if you've had 7 days, that can't be right. Well, all right, never mind. Drop day is sometime later in March. The reason I mention this is, unfortunately, there are some people who need to consider drop day as an option. I will be able to figure this out once I get your programming assignments done. And then I will be in personal contact with those people. So that takes care, and this is the only time that we're going to have 4 weeks, principally because of spring break. The remaining two sections will be both 3 weeks apiece. All right, I hope that clears up the mess that we have in this third section for various reasons, both in terms of having spring break and then all the weather disasters that have befallen us. Any questions about that? Next up is your quizzes. Your first quiz is back. If I didn't give them to you, they're here. I'd like to say a few words about the quizzes. The first one is, I mentioned it's important to look over, well, let me see. Let's just go over this item by item here. An interesting point about the first question is, notice that the last sentence in the question is justify your answer. All right, so I asked you to tell me whether the questions, and I see, because I was grading this, and I was noticing that, hey, people are only answering one question. They're only telling me that, for example, the first statement is false. They're not saying anything at all about the second statement. And after I got about halfway through, I said, well, maybe I did something wrong. So I went back and actually looked at the question, and I see that perhaps I didn't word it correctly, although it's not quite clear to me how I could word it so that I would get the expected output. What I expected was a judgment on each one, and I suppose I could write this down, a judgment on each one of the statements. Is statement one true? Is statement, or I guess I asked for false, doesn't make much difference. Is statement one false or is statement two false? And almost everybody said, oh, you know, statement one is false. But then they said nothing at all about statement two. Okay, well, that's a lot, and of course, a lot of people got points knocked off for that. Now, partially, I guess that's my problem because I somehow worded the question funny, but it's, like I said, it's not clear to me how I could word it otherwise. But the point is, again, make sure that you justify your answers. I mean, I suppose you could argue that, well, you know, statement true is two. Oh, boy. Statement, does anybody know what that's called offhand?
Yeah.
That little rhetorical or verbal, no, yeah, dyslexia. Let's be more polite. It's actually called a spoonerism because I essentially switched syllables of words. There was a 18th century English reverend called Spooner, and when he was officiating at a wedding, at the end of the wedding, you're supposed to say, it is customary to kiss the bride, and he switched those, and he said, it is customary to cuss the bride. So from that point on, those kinds of dyslexia is known as spoonerism. So you just heard a real-life spoonerism, and I forgot what I was saying. So I guess you could argue that, well, you know, statement two is true. Yeah, I guess that's why that was my first downfall. Statement two is true, so I don't need to say anything. But you have to justify your claim that statement two is true. Right? Again, make sure the explanations are there. That's why a lot of people lost points on question one, because they only answered one of the two statements and not both. Second point, I said it was important that you give not only grammatically reasonable answers, which most of you didn't, but it's also important that you give logically reasonable answers. And the question then becomes, well, how do I figure out what a logically reasonable answer is? And to a certain extent, that's what the quiz is for. But there is something I wanted to mention about a sort of a mechanical technique that you can use to determine whether or not your answer is reasonable. When you read questions, and this is not just for my quiz, this is a general useful heuristic for taking quizzes and exams. When you read a question, you should be looking out for the important words. Some of the words in the question is important, some of the words aren't. Right? You want to focus on the important words. So, for example, if you look at the first question, right, the first sentence is useless. It just tells you what to do. There's no important words there. The second statement is what I call the first statement. A stack can be implemented as a priority queue. Well, two important words there are stack and priority queue. Priority queue. And then, of course, the second statement repeats those two important words switched around, or phrases, and then justify your answer. Again, not particularly important. The reason that's important, not only to get you focused on what the question wants, but it's also a good way to figure out whether or not you have a good answer. And the way you can determine whether or not you have a good answer is you look at your answer and see if it includes what you consider to be the important words. In particular, your answer should contain the word stack, and your answer should contain the word priority queue. If your answer doesn't contain either one of those, then there's something really wrong with it, and you can't really expect to get a good grade on it. Okay. Now, a lot of people, I think almost everybody, put stack in their answer. Okay. But a lot of people put queue in their answer, which is only half the important word. Okay, you cannot possibly get a good grade on the first question if you just write Q. Right, because a priority queue is significantly different from a queue. And if you answer the question assuming it's about queues, you're going to get it wrong. Right, so this is a really nice mechanical way to make sure that you're giving reasonable answers. Just look to make sure what you consider to be important words in the question appear in your answer. This is really easy to do. Students do not do it. I don't understand why. But if you can do that, if you can answer the question without using the important words, you've done something wrong. Go back and think again. All right, and that's it for the first one. Questions about the first one? Second one, everybody pretty much did well on the second one. A couple of people just sort of blew it completely, but otherwise, everyone did pretty well. Third one was another example of not figuring out what the important words in the question were and making sure that those important words were somehow echoed in your answer. There's a lot of blah blah here. The important thing is that I'm asking you for a minimal sequence of linked sequence operations. Right, that's an important word. And I put this question three in here. I didn't tell you about why I did it, but I put it in there, and I'll point it out to you now, because there's going to be a question like question three on every quiz that goes forward. Question three is taken from your assignment, right? The assumption is you've done the assignment, so you know how to answer question three. And that's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for assignment-specific answers. So when I say linked sequence structure, I expect to see in your answer operators from the linked sequence structure. Push, pop, these are not instructions or methods from the linked sequence structure. Therefore, they are not acceptable answers. And I'm going to essentially have a question involving the assignment on every quiz. The assumption is you've done the assignment and you know how to answer the question. And if that assumption is not true, it will show up in your answer and your answer will get smacked. A lot of people got smacked because they said things like push and pop. Also, it says describe a, and I was actually, when I thought about it, you know, the smallest sequence was perhaps, although actually somebody actually did get the smallest sequence, which I thought was a very good answer. In fact, it was better than my answer because my answer was a little bit more cumbersome than theirs, so I took their answer and made it mine, which is the mark of a good question, or a good answer. The other important words in question three are smallest sequence of instructions. That's what I'm looking for. So if you wrote like this person, well, I guess this person wrote a little bit more than this, but if you wrote just like three statements, you'd be done. Okay? Because again, that's what I'm asking for. And of course, the justification why it works. Another one that people just blew, and this was just a dumb mistake. The last sentence is assume the linked sequence is empty. A lot of people didn't make that assumption. In fact, they explicitly contradicted it. So they just didn't apparently either read that part of the question or they didn't understand it. So that was just a pointless mistake, and I marked out. Actually, that's something else I should point out. Notice that there are no comments on your quiz. I guess I shouldn't do that since this is actually somebody's. But there are no this is going to be a fun lecture tonight, I can tell. There are no comments on your quiz. The comments are on the version of the quiz I have posted on the schedule. You can go look at the quiz that I posted. It will have everybody's answer on there and all my comments to everybody. So you can find your particular answer in that page and then compare the notes that I gave with what I gave you here. All right, so that's it for question three. Question four was, actually, I thought this one was going to be really easy, but I really don't understand a lot of the answers I got. But essentially the point is, I guess, let me ask this first. I perhaps made an unreasonable assumption. How many people know what undo is? How many people have like used Word or whatever and have actually done undo? All right, so most people are familiar with undo, right, in an application using Word or whatever. Well, the answers I got were just completely strange. People seem to be focusing on doing undo operations in the linked sequence ADT itself, which, if you look at the question and figure out what the important words are, no, that doesn't say, there's nothing like that in there. You have applications, undo operations, well, we don't really care about applications. And essentially, it just walks you through, you know, undoes previous commands. Previous, somebody actually, I think, even sort of circled previous, which is the right idea. And so that's the idea. I'm interested in implementing undo in an application. Doesn't make much difference what the application is. What's the best data structure to use? Okay. And it occurred to me, somebody gave me a really nice answer, except their answer was linked lists. And I had to think about it, and if you had a lot of experience with applications, you know that, in fact, some applications provide an undo stack as, in fact, a linked list. So you can actually traverse back and forth in the sequence of prior operations to figure out where it is you want to undo to. To a certain extent, a lot of software configuration management systems are like that. So from that point of view, even though I was looking for a stack, the fact that this person said linked list and then justified it was a reasonable answer. But that's essentially an example of trying to figure out what the question is asking you for and then answering it. So two sentences. Use a stack to store undo information because you can only undo the most recently performed operation. That's last in, first out behavior. That's a stack. You're done. That's it. And that's why I thought this question was a gimme, but it turns out a lot of people didn't do quite as well as I thought. And And that is all I have to say about the quiz. Like I said, if you're interested in comments on your particular problems or your particular answers, you can go look on the schedule under quiz one, and you can see what I posted for that, for your particular answers. You can look at everybody's answer for that matter there or not. You can't figure out, unless you know, you can't figure out who answered what. So from that point of view, it's not too bad. All your quizzes are going to be like this. This is essentially the way it's going to be from here on out. Questions? Sorry?
How many quizzes do we have?
Four.
So is it going to be each quiz on the day that the assignment's due?
Yes.
When's the next one due?
Assignment?
Yes.
I think it's the 23rd. Well, I can answer your question specifically. Yes, the 23rd of March. So that is when the next, that's quiz two, and that's assignment two, is due on the 23rd. Notice that there's spring break here. And, like I said, your midterm grades are due on the 16th, so programming assignment one and quiz one are going to make up your midterms. We're just going to do straightforward averaging. So add the two together, divide by two, there's your midterm grade. Wow, that was confusing. Any questions? Any other questions? All right, programming assignment one, for some reason, I cannot break the habit of printing things out and looking at them, so I will print them out when we're done. I hope to have your programming assignment one back on Thursday. I usually like to have like a one-hour code review also, which I actually think is important, but because we are running behind because of our snow days and such like, I don't know how we're going to do that. I'll try and stick it in, but I can't promise anything. That was programming assignment one, and programming assignment two is due, is officially now out, and I will talk about it on Thursday if anybody has any questions about that. Any questions about what we have talked about? All right, so now we can get down to the lecture at hand. I started the lecture on whenever it was we took quiz one, the second half of that day, I started the lecture, but I might as well just start over again from scratch since it was so long ago. What we'll be talking about is asymptotic estimates. Again, this week we'll be talking about asymptotic estimates, and I suspect we will carry on until the week after spring break, although we can't carry on too far. And then the week after spring break, we will talk about performance measurement. Start off by talking a little bit about algorithms and programs, and in particular, given some group of algorithms, how can you distinguish between them, or not, depending upon what you want to do. We are going to discuss several possibilities that you can use and focus on one that's called asymptotic estimates. Based on the idea of asymptotic estimates, I'll then give you a framework that you can use to base analysis based on asymptotic estimates, and then we'll actually run through how to do asymptotic estimates using a technique that's known as structural analysis. Let's do recall. What is this? For those of you that were here on 2 weeks, or was it 2 weeks ago? No, it was last week. Or quick on the draw. What is this? David?
Linear search.
This is linear search. What does a linear search do?
Runs through all of the...
Well, just give me functional behavior. Don't tell me how it does it. Tell me what it does.
Finds an element in an array.
Okay, so given an array and an integer, an array of integers and an integer, it essentially looks for the given integer x in the given array A. If it finds it, it returns I. If it doesn't find it, it returns an invalid index, minus 1, whatever. It looks like this. This is what the code looks like. This is what most of you wrote when we did that little experiment about code cheating. So this is a program. This is one way to look for an element in an array. What is this? Okay. What does it do? Again, tell me functionally what it does. Don't tell me how it works. Oh, okay, well then, what does it do? How does it work? And then we can figure out what it does. This is actually a tough one to figure out. Well, it's a little harder anyway. I don't know if it's tough. But
it goes through an array and searches for x.
Right. Given an array X, sorry, given an array A and an integer X, it essentially answers the question, is X in the integer array? This has the same functional behavior as the previous program. It does the same thing. Although, of course, there's a lot more code here. It's bigger than this, which is interesting. Why is it bigger? What's the point? But that's not our important question here. Our important question here is we have two procedures, methods, functions, if you want, that apparently do the same thing. Which one is better? That's the question. That's the important question. That's the question you need to be able to answer as a professional, because that's the question you're going to be answering over and over again. Either you're going to be asking yourself this, or other people are going to be asking you. So this is the essence of what you're going to be doing for the rest of your life. And of course, this question applies all over the place. But as far as we're concerned, we're just interested with respect to algorithms and programs. Essentially, the things that we are going to be talking about in this section are going to help you answer this question in a particular way. There are lots of different ways to answer that question. We're only going to be looking at a couple of them. We had a little discourse about this word. Of course, when I ask you the question, well, which program is better? The first question you should answer back is, exactly, what do you mean by better or define better? The point here is that there are lots of programs. All of them are different. Which program is best? Or which program, not to worry too much about extremes, which program is suitable? Sometimes you don't really care what the best program is. You just want to know if the program will do the job. Sometimes you really do care. But most of the time, it's like, does it work? Can I get it to work? Go. As we indicated, suitability or best depends upon what your criteria is. You could be worried about, for example, how much storage does your program use when you execute it? How long does it take to execute? How many messages does it send? This is an important aspect of programs and algorithms when you're talking about mobile devices. Every message you send kills your battery a little bit. So you want to have algorithms that run with a minimum of message sends, or receives for that matter. That turns out to be a really important way to look at algorithms and programs, one that hasn't really, well, that's not quite true, but at least the importance of power consumption with respect to being able to send and receive messages is a relatively new aspect of looking at algorithms, certainly within the past, I would say, 10 years or so. We are essentially going to abstract all that stuff away. We are not going to be overly concerned with looking at particular aspects like message count or the amount of storage. What we are going to do is we're going to abstract all those things and say, well, what we're interested in is execution time. All of the different ways that we can look at an algorithm or a program will essentially be condensed down into how much time does it take. The justification for that is performance is usually related to other criteria. If you are interested in, for example, how many messages get sent, well, it takes time to send a message. So it makes sense that if you have an algorithm that runs in a particular period of time, it sends so many messages. And if you have an algorithm that runs for a longer period of time, then it sends more messages. That's the assumption that we're going to make here. Why is that a bad assumption? It's a bad assumption, but we're going to make it. What's wrong with that assumption? How can it go wrong? Performance is usually related to other criteria.
Other than never use messages?
Well, any other criteria other than the amount of time it takes. The example I gave in particular was the number of message sends. But, for example, memory use. All right, I can make the same argument. If I'm going to use this much memory, then you can assume that I'm going to touch, and again, this is not a particularly good assumption, I'm going to touch every cell of memory that I have. Or, you know, you can say, well, perhaps you're over-allocating, and that's possible, but let's assume not. All right. So if I access this much memory, it's going to take me this much time to run. And if I access this much memory, it's going to take me longer to run. So by looking at the amount of time it takes, I'm using that as a surrogate for the amount of memory I'm using, or the number of messages I'm sending, or whatever else I'm interested in. That's the assumption we're going to use, but what's wrong with that assumption? Well, there's a lot of things wrong with it. What are some of the things wrong with that assumption?
I guess every program is different. Maybe the one works better for your program. With the linear binary thing, maybe your array or whatever you're using isn't in order and the right like sequence, so you can't use the binary. So linear would be better, even though it takes more time. I don't know.
That's true. But does that answer the question I'm asking is, what's wrong with this assumption? That we can relate execution time, and that's what I mean by performance here, execution time to other resource use. I've given you the pro argument. It's like, well, you know, if you're going to use a resource, it takes time. If you're going to use more of the resource, it's going to take more time. So we can just sort of skip all that other stuff and look at time. Well, actually, we'll get to that in a second. But suppose that I do the comparison on the same system.
Some of it could be like cache, and some of it could be...
Yes. Well, that's true, too. Yes, that's a good example. That's a little bit more detailed than what I was looking for. But yes, that's a good point. In fact, that's why this is such a pain in the neck, is you've got to worry about cache effects, and you also have at the other end of the cache scale, you have the disk, right? Some, you may have to whistle in pages from disk, in which case you get it in the neck. So... But at a more basic level, what's wrong with this assumption? I mean, I'm hammering on this because you have to understand the problems associated with the assumptions that you use.
Do you assume that it always takes the same amount of time to go through like one cycle? So that time might not be your constant? Like one cycle usually takes a second, but maybe after a while it doesn't take a second anymore?
Yeah, if you're talking about, for example, a multitasking operating system, you could get booted out of the CPU at the wrong time and it takes you a while to get back. That's true, but... that's more an issue of measurement. How, you know, what could be wrong with the measurement of your amount of time? What I'm talking about is the relationship between time and other resource use. Well, we have to move on, so let me just answer the question. The principal problem is the assumption that the only time-critical use of the resource is the one that you're interested in. If I'm going to essentially say that, well, we'll use the amount of time it takes to touch memory as a surrogate for the amount of memory you have, that ignores the fact that you could also be sending messages, which takes a lot of time. So it's difficult to isolate a particular resource in terms of the time it needs to take that, to access that resource, to use that resource. That's the problem with this assumption. We're not going to be worried about that for reasons that we'll talk about in a couple of minutes. All right, so this is the basic idea. We are essentially going to look at programs and answer the question, which is better, by considering resource use, but through the lens of execution time. Now we can go back to sort of your question or your answer. How do we do that? Well, you can measure performance or measure time. You can determine performance, program performance, either through measurement or through estimation, which are the two topics that we're going to be covering in this section. You can measure execution time, which is a relatively, well, not quite straightforward thing to do. We'll get into that next week. Actually, not next week, but the week after. Now, you can certainly do that. The problem is you have to have a program to actually execute. If you are developing new code, one of the first things you'll do is you'll try and figure out what algorithms you can use in your code. When you develop those algorithms, at that point, you don't have anything that you can execute. But you still have to ask the question, which one of these algorithms is better? Again, whatever your criteria for better means. So certainly one of the things you can do is you can implement all your algorithms. So you come up with, for example, with three different algorithms to do something, and what you can do is you can implement all three of them and measure them. That's a pain because the idea is you just want to implement one of them, the one that actually is most suitable, rather than all three of them. There are other problems associated with this which we actually don't have to get into at this point. We'll come back to this later. Well, measurement seems like a good idea. I mean, it gives you nice, hard answers. On this system, as we've seen in previous lectures here, as well as pretty much any place else where you look at technical information, on this system, I ran this program and got these results. And you can argue with it. We had one example. I think, well, you know, did you compensate for cache effects? Was the cache warm? Was it cold? And that's an indication of one of the problems you can have. Measurements are context-dependent, extremely sensitive to the context in which you take those measurements. And, more importantly, and unfortunately, determining context is difficult. Because there's lots, I mean, modern computing systems are extremely complicated. And trying to characterize all the things that could influence your measurements is essentially, I would think, impossible. Another problem related to the first one, which I guess someone, was perhaps you mentioned, is, or maybe it was, is it James? If I have two different contexts, then I can't compare results because the contexts are different. Okay? In order for comparisons, measured comparisons, to be meaningful from one system to the next, the contexts have to be more or less related. As a consequence of all this, taking meaningful measurements is hard. You can certainly do it, but it requires a reasonable amount of care and an irritating amount of care. There's lots of niggling little details you've got to get right, because if you don't, they will influence your measurements to such an extent that your measurements no longer become comparable. And if you do the comparison, then you could run into problems in terms of the results you draw. As I said, we'll sort of take care of this next week when we talk about measuring performance. Now we're going to be talking about the alternative, which is to estimate performance. So that sounds like a lot of work. So let's see what else we can do. And of course, we can rely on a basic rule of thumb. If you don't know something, you can guess, which is the undignified way to state it. Of course, the more dignified way is if you don't know, you can estimate. And why is that an advantage? Why is guessing better than measuring? It's quicker, certainly. And anything else? It's sort of a consequence of being quicker. Right, that's going to be a problem, but we'll turn. Actually, that turns out to be not quite a difficult issue. Did you?
If you measure it, there's a possibility that it's wrong, whereas if you guess, it's not really. Like, if you measure it, there's a possibility that you made a mistake.
Right.
Whereas if you guess, like, you know it's not exact.
Okay, so you're saying that you have an assumption with a guess or an estimate that you know it's not accurate, whereas if you are not particularly sharp or on the ball, you will believe that your measurements are accurate. Okay, that's true. That's true. We can actually make that a little bit stronger. Both are going to be wrong. Both your measurements and any estimates you make are going to be wrong. But you really may not understand why your measurements are wrong. Again, because of the complexity of the context involved. The reason that your measurements are wrong is because you're either looking at the wrong thing or you're measuring the wrong thing, and it's hard to understand where those mistakes occur because of the complexity of your environment. Whereas when you estimate something, you know that you're going to be wrong, and more importantly, you understand the points at which you could be wrong. Those are the assumptions that you make to do your estimation. Those assumptions could be wrong. The reason you can do that is, and this is what I was trying to get at earlier, it's simpler. It's faster to estimate, but it's also simpler. And that's the important point. Another reason that estimation is a useful skill to have is that, in my opinion, you can indicate the skill level of a professional by the way in which they estimate, how they estimate, and how their estimates turn out. Okay, that's one of the things I like to do when I hire people to do jobs or anything like that, is give them some tasks that make them estimate, and then watch them estimate and see how they do it, see if they can explain themselves. If they can do a good job estimating, that's probably a person that you want to deal with. Okay, so this is sort of a meta-level comment, but it's an important one. At least I think it's an important one, so it's one I'm going to try and get across. All right? What are the advantages to doing estimation over performance? And then we can turn this around next week. Estimates are essentially more comparable than measurements. If I take two estimates, then because I'm controlling the context, I can determine whether or not they're comparable. And as we'll see, the ability to create estimates is comparable over a wide range of different algorithms and programs, as opposed to measuring, which you are essentially stuck on the system that you measure. And again, the reason that estimates are comparable is because of the context. You essentially ignore it. Estimates are more durable. As a consequence of ignoring the context, estimates are more durable. In other words, if you make an estimation of an algorithm, that estimation doesn't change when the new revision of the compiler is released. If somebody releases, for example, they just released a new version of Haskell, which uses the lower level VM. And so all the measurements you made for your Haskell programs are now invalid because there's a new compiler that does much better in some forms of optimization. That's not a problem, however, if you estimate your programs, to the extent that you can estimate Haskell programs, which turns out to be difficult, but that's not the point here. All right, so estimates are more durable. They're not as closely tied to hardware or software technology is the point. Again, this is the issue of we're kind of, you know, pushing away the context. We are just interested in the thing itself. Okay, so that's sort of a theoretical, not very theoretical, but a semi, well, no, not even semi, but a quasi-theoretical estimate, justification for what we're doing here. Any questions about that? All right, let's go on. How do we do this? How do we do this estimation? What are we going to do? How are we going to carry it out? There's lots of different ways that you can estimate algorithms. There's lots of different ways that you, again, this goes back to the issue of, well, what do we mean by better? There's lots of different ways that you can characterize how good an algorithm is or a program. Similarly, there's lots of different ways that you can estimate an algorithm. We are going to use a particularly simple but also particularly powerful technique. We are essentially going to count. We are going to model the algorithm by counting important parts of the program. We are going to consider what's important to us, and as I mentioned, it's going to be largely execution time, and then we're going to count. That is going to give us our estimation, our model of our algorithm, or program for that matter. So essentially what we're doing here is we're taking our algorithms and we're reducing them to counts. Okay, that's how we're going to do our estimation. The important thing here is make sure that you understand what is being counted. And that's going to be fairly simple for us. We are essentially going to be counting one thing, which is statements. That's essentially, as we'll see, what we're going to be counting. We're just going to look at algorithms and figure out how many statements execute. That gives us a reasonable measure in terms of execution time. But there are lots of other things that you can count. I mean, if you're really into it, you can count memory references and so forth and so on. You're going to use the same techniques that we're going to be talking about here with respect to statements, but you're just going to have to use more detail, which we're not going to have to deal with in this class. Just to give you some examples, let's take a sorting algorithm, which we're going to talk about at the end of this class. This will be the last section. We can model a sorting algorithm by counting, like I said. What are we going to count? Well, what we're interested in a sorting algorithm, we could be interested in lots of things, but principally what we're going to be interested in is the amount of time it takes to sort n elements. Given an n element array, I want it sorted, how long is it going to take? Other things I could be interested in are the amount of time, the amount of space it takes. How much, given that I want to sort an n element array, how much space do I need to do that? This actually turns out to be important for external sorts, which I'm not going to talk about, so that's why I'm not going to talk about it here. Other things that we could be interested in is the number of comparisons rather than individual statements. This turns out to be important for distinguishing between algorithms that look the same in terms of the number of statements they execute. The number of elements that are moved. This is actually a fairly important way to look at sorting algorithms because, as I mentioned, one of the things you don't want to do is touch data. Okay, and in order to move it, you have to touch it. So what you'd like to do is have sorting algorithms that move the smallest amount of data. So that's another thing that you can count. With respect to databases, I guess there weren't a lot of database people here, so I'll just go quickly over this. You have distributed databases, which are important, actually getting to be even more important. So what you'd like to know is, for example, how many messages are sent to commit a transaction. You have various ways of committing a transaction. Each one of those ways has different properties. So what you need to do is figure out some way to compare those, and one of the ways you can do it is in terms of the number of messages it sends. Or the time it takes to commit a transaction. How long does it take to commit a transaction? This one is actually tricky because the context is extremely important here. Or the number of times a transaction can be overtaken and aborted. This is actually a probabilistic analysis, which we're not going to get into. So that's the way that we are going to do our estimates here. We are going to essentially count things. All right, questions about that? Now, how are we going to do the counting? Counting sounds tedious, right? 1, 2, 3. How are we going to do this? It can also be difficult to get right. You have to figure out, again, we're going to be talking about something at a fairly large level. We're going to be talking about statements. But even when you talk about statements, that can get actually kind of tricky. So again, rather than actually do the work, if you don't know, then you can guess. So what we're going to do is we're going to actually not only estimate the algorithm by counting, but we're also going to estimate the count. All right, so we're essentially going to turn the crank once again. And as it was with the first estimation, going from program or algorithm to count, there's a lot of different ways to go from counts to estimating the counts. What we are going to use is what's known as an upper bound. We are essentially going to estimate the count by asking the question, what is the largest possible value it could be? Okay, this is different from asking exactly what can it be. Why is that useful? Why is having an upper bound on a count a useful thing to ask for? David?
Because then you know the theoretical worst case scenario.
Exactly, you know the worst case. And this is another term for upper bound analysis. It's also known as worst case analysis. How bad can things get? It's a pessimistic analysis, if you will. So it represents potential worst case behavior. There are other bounds possible. Can anybody think of some bounds that you might be interested in terms of counting, estimate counting?
Lower bound. Lower
bound, exactly. What's the best you can do? What is the lowest possible count you could get? Lower bounds are extremely difficult to get. And there's one, well, actually there's lots more, but there's one more that's sort of, which, yeah, give me a more dignified term for middle. Median, exactly, the average case. Average cases, are you can find those, but the mathematics is really difficult. You have to essentially rely on lots of probabilistic algorithms. But those are the three typical bounds that you will see. You'll see an uppercase, sorry, not uppercase, worst case bound, best case bound, and then the average case in the middle. We are going to be concerned almost entirely with worst case bounds. Every once in a while, we'll have a cheap and easy lower case, which I'll mention. For the most part, we are not going to have easy average case bounds. Is that true? I seem to remember there's like one or two easy average case bounds. Well, if we come across them, I'll point them out. And like I said, there are lots of other kinds of bounds that you can put on counts. Now we can come up with some terminology. This is a really old concept. This has been around in mathematics since, I would suspect, the end of the 19th century. So there's actually a large amount of mathematics associated with this. It was, I suppose we could say, revitalized, or no, perhaps not revitalized. It was rearranged in the probably 60s, but for the most part, it's more or less the same as it's been for the past two centuries. What we need is a definition of what it means to be an upper bound or a worst case. It's a lot more complicated than this, but as far as we're concerned, this is all we're going to need. An upper bound of some value, some count, is a function with the property that function is at least the value of the function that we're interested in. And you're allowed to put a constant here, which is a positive constant, and you're allowed to let n get as large as you like. Those are technical reasons. We're not going to go into that, but I will mention them for completeness. So this is what an upper bound is. This is actually what we're going to be interested in. This is our estimate. This is the thing that we're going to be producing. So an alternative way to say that is that f of n is never larger than g of n. F of n is never larger than your upper bound, which makes sense. That's why it's an upper bound. That's why it's a worst case. The reason I mention this, n grows without bound, is because that gives the name to this kind of estimation. This is what's known as an asymptotic estimate. We essentially allow n to ride the asymptote out to infinity to get our estimation. We are not going to worry about that, but that's where it comes from. Because I'm also going to be saying asymptotic analysis. This is where the asymptote comes from. You're allowed essentially to let n go to infinity to get your answer. And there's technical reasons why you want to do this, but we're not going to get into that. I just mention it because that gives us the name, asymptotic analysis. Okay? Asymptotic estimates have a lot of notations. We are essentially going to look at the notations that are associated with the worst case or upper bound estimations. And in particular, I'm going to introduce the all-important notation big O. An alternative representation for f of n's upper bound, which remember is a function, is O of f. Okay, so I have some function that I'm interested in estimating and I want to produce its upper bound. I essentially say its upper bound is big O of f. So you can think of, in mathematical terms, big O is known as an operator. So in other words, g of n, which is our upper bound from the previous slide, is big O of f. This notation is correct, but it's not, you don't use it in the way that I'm using it here. This is only part of the story. It gets extremely technical and sort of nitpicky, but we don't need to go into that. I just want to introduce the big O notation because that is what we're going to be using to indicate our estimates as we go along. All right? Any questions? What kind of properties, then, can we figure out about asymptotic estimates? What do we know, given that we know that an asymptotic estimate is a worst-case upper bound, about properties associated with that worst-case upper bound? We're actually going to need three properties. Well, here's one of them. What does it say? Right. What does that mean? Okay, and what's the justification for that? Why is that true? That's what you're right. That's what it means. Why is that true? Or maybe it isn't. Maybe I just put this up here to mess with you.
Going for an amount, and that is like the most of the worst case scenario. So that's why is that was down. Yes.
Since O of F is like the worst case scenario, shouldn't it be F prime is less than or equal to O of F?
No, you see, that's what my comment over here was. This is actually not equality. The notation that was developed in the 60s was awful, just completely awful. It makes sense if you understand what's going on, but if you don't, then it makes absolutely no sense. So the answer is no. If you want, I can explain it to you after class, but I'm not going to do it now, because it will just confuse everyone. Never mind. Why is this true? What does it mean to be an upper bound?
Keep going up and keep getting worse.
Oh, not necessarily. That's
where it stops, though. Like, on what he said. He said it keeps going up, but the very highest that it can be.
What can be?
The worst case.
Okay, so if that's all right, and we'll accept that, why is this true then?
Because of the constant.
Can you explain further? What is the constant? All right, let me ask the question this way. What is the constant in this case? What is the constant in this case? Sorry?
One.
Yes, one. It's one, right? Now, the question is, why is it one? You want to answer that one, too?
I just know that y in the equation, because in order for them to be equal, c would have to be one, but I don't know, like, the exact...
Well, what's g, then? The upper bound, right. So what are we saying is the upper bound here?
One.
No, that's the constant. What's the upper bound?
Of that.
Yes, that's true, but...
Oh, yeah, the function.
The function itself. Right. The function itself is always at least the function, right? That's why the constant is 1. If this is f of n, then certainly 1 times f of n is at least f of n. That is why any function is its own upper bound.
And then, if the constant wasn't 1, then that would be true.
Well, notice that we can make the constant be 2. Is this still true if c is 2?
That's true, but the other one would be because it would be greater than it, wouldn't it?
Well, that's fine. What does this say? There you go. So if we put a 2 here, we have 2 f of n is the upper bound of f. Is that true or false?
If c is 2.
Right.
Then yeah.
Okay, why?
Because that's saying that f of n could equal g of n anyway.
Right.
But if the constant isn't 1...
Right.
If it's 2, which would make g of n bigger.
Right.
By 2.
Right.
You're timesing f of n by 2, so what you do to one side, you do to the other.
We'll go back to the other problem. This is actually not an equality relationship. So I'm actually spending way too much time on this. But to answer the question, if f of n is at least n... Right, f of n. If f of n is at least f of n, then twice f of n is certainly at least f of n too, right? Exactly. You're multiplying, right. If I have one thing that's larger than another, and then I double the larger thing, it's still larger. All right, that was, we spent way too much time on it. So let's move on. Another one is estimate addition. If I have two estimates and I add them together, what I'm interested in is what is the upper bound on those two estimates? And the answer is essentially larger estimates swallow up smaller ones. That's the rule we're going to use. And there's another technical point. Notice that the maximum of the function, this is what's known as the pointwise maximum, but the maximum of f and g may not exist as n grows without bound. This is why asymptotic analysis is a little tricky. You have to actually argue for the existence of this maximum. We're not going to do that because all the algorithms that we look at, this exists. So we don't have to worry about that at all. The only thing you have to remember is if I have two estimates and I'm adding them together, then I can estimate the addition of two estimates by looking at the estimate of the upper bound. And we'll come back to why we want this in a couple of minutes. Questions about that? And it's actually, if you sit there and draw on paper, you can see why this is true. Although, sort of sit there and think about what this means, it should also be fairly clear. The last one is estimate multiplication. If I have two estimates and I multiply them together, then how do I estimate the result of that product? And the answer is, you estimate the product of the functions. So the product of estimates is equal to the estimate of the product. And that's an easy way to remember that one. Okay, and those are, the last two in particular are the important ones that we're going to need when we do, when we finally get to structural analysis. But these three are useful properties. Not so much the first one, but the other two. Questions about that? I think the last thing we're going to talk about, yes, the last thing we're going to talk about is an important term, one that you hear frequently, and one that I have to admit is sort of, this is my interpretation of what it means. I've never actually seen a formal definition of what it means, but this is reasonably close, at least for what we're going to be doing. And that is the notion of estimate quality. How do you know when you have a good estimate? Let's see if you can figure this out. Given what I've said so far, there's something really wrong here, and what is it? If you go back to what I meant by our upper bound estimate, there's something really wrong about that. And what is it? Particularly in terms of estimates.
We don't have accurate error.
Let's see. That's true, but we don't much care because these are estimates, right? And furthermore, we have, as we'll see when we go along, we have some way of getting an idea of how accurate they are. So that's true, but we're not going to worry about that. You would have to worry about it in a more advanced class, but not in this class. Going back to the definition of what it means to be an upper bound and what we are trying to do, there's an obvious problem here. It's actually kind of related to this slide, yes.
What if the two algorithms are very, like the worst case is almost the same?
That's fine. That's exactly what we're looking for. In fact, that's the kind of thing we're looking for. Then essentially what we say is, given what we are estimating, those algorithms are indistinguishable. And we have to either look for something else to estimate that will distinguish them, which is actually why I mentioned this back here, comparisons versus elements. We are, like I said, we are going to be looking at, in the last section, a number of different sorts. Right? All those sorts are essentially going to be n-squared, what are known as order n-squared sorts. Okay. For example, selection sort, insertion sort, bubble sort, selection, insertion, what's the third one? I forget the third one, huh? Well, anyway, so we have a bunch of n-squared sorts, and the question is, how do they differ? And in fact, they do differ, right? And one of the ways you can see that they differ is by counting something else. Counting the way, for example, the number of times you move an element versus the number of times you do a comparison. So that's actually a good point, but it's one that we're not going to have need of until we get, actually, we're certainly going to see this when we get to sorting and searching. Whether we see it early or not, I can't say right offhand. All right, so the question is, what's wrong with this definition of estimation I gave you?
Okay, so up there, G is the worst case scenario of F, right?
Yes. And well, let me not, because actually you're getting it exactly wrong. Not the worst case, a worst case. Right.
A worst case.
Exactly. Right.
H is a worst case scenario of G, so
that's true.
H is a worst case scenario of a worst case scenario.
Yes, that's true. What's wrong with that?
How does that make sense? If it's the worst case scenario, how can it be any worse?
Ah, well, now you're edging closer to the problem. So what would you do instead? How would you fix that problem? Well, it's we don't care. I mean, it's the number of comparisons in selection sort. Anything, whatever you want, doesn't matter, as long as it's a function, of course.
But you don't really need H,
do you?
If G is
well, that's actually the point of the slide. But I want to try and motivate why we're talking about this at all. And you're sort of close. Let me, since we have to move on, let me just answer the question. We're looking at our worst case, right? And this is sort of, and it's like James, right? I'll eventually get this. The problem is exactly the reverse of what you said, right? It's true that G is an upper bound for F of N, right? But then so is H. Yes?
No.
Okay. But of course, I can draw something on top of H. So I can draw another upper bound on top of H, and I can draw another upper bound on top of that. So I can just keep creating upper bounds. There are essentially an infinity of upper bounds, right? And that's the problem with defining a worst case, because it can always get worse, right? It's a good statement of life. No matter how bad it is, you can always make it worse. So from that point of view, what good is that as an estimate? It's kind of like saying, you know, I have to go grocery shopping. How much money do I need? And the answer is, oh, you need $11 billion. Well, that's an upper bound on the amount of money you actually need, but it's not a very useful upper bound. So what we need is we need some way to present reasonable upper bounds that are, in fact, worst case, but at least are not worst case in the sense of you need $11 billion. That's what the notion of tightness indicates. You have a tight estimate when you have an estimate that is an upper bound to what you're trying to estimate, but it is the closest upper bound or the closest reasonable upper bound. Right. And that's what this picture shows. So we have one upper bound on F, which is G. Okay, so here's F, some function, some measurement of or some count of our algorithm. And then here's an estimate that we make as to the upper bound on F. Okay, and here's another estimate we make as to an upper bound on F. And the question is, which one is better? And the answer is the tighter of the two. And you can give a technical definition to what it means to be tighter, which is essentially if one upper bound is the upper bound of the other. So in other words, notice that H is an upper bound of G, right? At least the way I've drawn it here. Okay, then G, yes, sorry.
Okay, so since these are just estimates, that means they can actually be worse than just the estimate.
Right.
So if the worst case scenario, like if we get a scenario that's like above G but below H, does that make G no longer an upper bound?
With respect to what now? With respect to F?
With respect to F.
All right, so we can do that. And what do you want? What do you want to do?
Say our scenario, like it comes up that F of N is like the scenario we get is between G and H.
So you're saying F of N is
G but not as bad as H.
F of N is up here?
Yeah. Does that make G no longer an upper bound?
Okay, so what's the answer?
The answer is it's a lower bound.
Right, the answer is it's a lower bound. I haven't actually defined what lower bound means, but if you just think about what it means to be an upper bound and then flip the sense of the comparison. Right, so a lower bound would be C of G is at most F of N, or C of G is at most F. Okay, so essentially what I did was I took the at least and flipped it around. Okay? So was that your question?
Kind of. I kind of answered it.
Okay, well.
Yeah, I just don't want to say, like, so then G of N becomes a lower bound?
This version of F, yes.
Yeah.
And notice that H still remains an upper bound.
Okay.
Now, of course, this looks kind of dangerous here, right? Because we don't know how it's going to, if it goes like this, then G of N is, well, let me retreat. G of N would actually still, sorry, yes, G of N would still be an upper bound because remember, we allow N to go to infinity, right? And so we don't care what happens here because I can run away over here. So, but that's a technical detail we're not going to get into. Questions about that? All right, so that's what it means to be a tighter estimate. G is a tighter estimate than H of F. Okay, and this is going to be important because I'm going to ask you on quizzes for tight estimates. So anybody have any questions about that? There's actually another problem here, which is the same problem that we had with going up, infinitely up, we have the same problem going down. Notice that I said with respect to H, G is a tighter estimate of F. But I can always draw another function in here that is tighter than G. And then I can always draw another function which is tighter than my other tighter, my previous tighter. And I can just keep doing that infinitely often too. So the question is, how do we ever stop? You can stop when it's convenient, of course. But another way to do it is to have a fixed repertoire of estimates and essentially just do your analysis to these estimates. This essentially defines your recipe of estimates that you can get, and once you get one of these, you can stop. So essentially we're going to create a hierarchy, and we're going to step through that hierarchy in the next couple of slides, but this is the typical hierarchy that you'll see when you read various papers, in particular when you, for example, read textbooks and so forth. And the hierarchy goes from, as we'll see, best to some extent worst. So we have what are known as constant upper bounds, and those are signified by order one. Constant upper bounds are nirvana. All of your algorithms should have a constant upper bound. Okay, this is where you want to be. This is heaven. Okay, and of course, generally speaking, you're not going to get there. Although we have actually seen an operation, a data structure that supports a very important constant time operation. Anybody know what that is? Array indexing is a constant time operation. Doesn't matter where you index into the array, it takes you the same amount of time. Okay, so that's an example of a constant time operation. Another example is hash table searching. In the ideal case, if you set your hash table up well, you can get constant time searches in hash tables, which is why people like hash tables. Next best after constant time is what's known as log time, logarithmic time, or logarithmic worst case. Binary search, as we argued, I guess, a week ago today, is logarithmic worst-case behavior. Linear search is linear worst-case, order n behavior. Important for sorting, log linear is n log n, worst-case time. Heap sort is an example of an n log n sort. Quadratic, n squared, bubble sort, selection sort, insertion sort, all those sorts that we were talking about earlier. Cubic, order n cubed, matrix multiplications, other kinds of graphics algorithms generally are order n cubed. And then the worst case that we're going to consider in this class, exponential, actually I don't even think we're going to consider it in this class, is exponential, order n, order 2 to the n. Things like optimal root finding are exponential worst case algorithms. Typical naming, between here, from here on up, they're known as polynomial order worst case bounds. So there's quadratic, cubic, and so on. We'll actually talk about quadratic or polynomial algorithms. That's what we mean, algorithms that have polynomial worst case behavior. And like I said, we'll have examples of this, most of these, I guess, as we go along. So let's start with the beginning. What does it mean when you say that something has constant behavior? Essentially what you're saying is the amount of time, or whatever it is you're counting, time in our case, that the algorithm takes is independent of n, independent of the number of values that you're operating over. So a picture of that would look like this, essentially a straight line. So no matter where you have a value of n, you're going to get the same value as your estimate. Right? That's why it's constant time. This is input-independent behavior. This is what we all want. This is ideal, like I said, but we're not going to get it in most cases. The other thing you should be careful of, which we don't have to worry about, is what is the value of C? Right? If C is a small number like 2 or 3, not a problem. On the other hand, if C is 11 billion, that's still constant, but it may not be very good for what you're trying to do.
And an example of this is array indexing?
Array indexing, right. Because it doesn't matter, you know, your array could be 2 million elements long. It's going to take you the same amount of time to access the last element than it is the first one. So that's essentially constant behavior. You would like to have that for all your data structures. And if you're exceptionally lucky and clever, you can do it, but for the most part, it's not going to be possible. Next up is logarithmic behavior. Okay, and this is essentially repeated dividing behavior. This is the kind of behavior you get when you take something and you divide it in half. Then you divide it in half again, and you keep dividing it in half till you get down to single elements. Right? That's repeated division, and if you think about that for a little while, you can only do that logarithmically many times. So if you have a logarithmic upper bound, you have something that looks like this. As n gets larger, notice that this sort of takes off very quickly, but it also very quickly flattens out. And this is the nice thing about logarithmic behavior. In fact, we talked about this a week ago. If you take the logarithm of a million, it's 20. If you remember that discussion we had last time, that's why logarithms are nice, is because essentially they flatten things out as n gets large. I mean, it still grows, right? You notice this is still increasing, but it doesn't increase as quickly. Linear behavior is essentially touch every element. Right? You have n elements, and you have to touch every one. That's linear behavior. Why is linear search linear? That's not quite true, right? Because suppose the first element is the element I need, right? So how many elements then am I going to touch? Right. So why did I say that linear search is worst case linear behavior?
Because it has the potential to touch every element.
And that potential occurs when?
When it's the last element. When the element you're looking for is the last thing that you touch.
Okay, you can actually do a little bit better than that even. Well, that's the same answer you just gave. Okay. What's the next step you can make? That's almost the worst case. What's the worst case?
It's not in there.
Exactly. When it's not in the array, you have to touch every element. It's essentially equivalent to yours, but it illustrates that we're talking about, and this is the problem that James had, we are looking for the worst case. Make sure you understand what you're counting. Right. So it certainly is true, in the best case, the element that you're looking for is the first element you look at, and wow, you have constant time access. But unless you can guarantee that's true for every possible data structure that you're going to create, then that's not the worst case. You need to look at the worst case, which is you have to touch every element when the value is not in the array you're looking for. Okay, and this is an important part of doing worst case analysis. Make sure you understand what the worst case is. So clearly, linear search has worst case behavior that's linear. If I have a 1,000 element array, or if I have a 1,000,000 element array, I'm going to have to touch a 1,000,000 elements before I figure out X is not in the array. Clearly, if you compare that to binary search, I only have to touch 20 elements as opposed to 1,000,000. So you can see the advantage to having a logarithmic find as opposed to a linear find. In general, a logarithmic algorithm versus a linear one. The combination of the two, logarithmic and linear, gives you log linear or n log n. This is essentially sorting behavior. Okay, and what you do here in order to get n log n behavior, as you might expect, we get linear behavior by touching every element. We get logarithmic behavior by dividing repeatedly. So how do we get n log n behavior? For every element, you divide repeatedly. So that gives you n log n behavior. Remember, the estimate of products is the product of the estimates is the estimate of the product, which you can kind of see that here. Notice, again, this is linear behavior from the previous slide. This is n log n behavior. Notice that this sort of grows significantly faster than linear. So even though linear is bad compared to logarithmic behavior, it's not too bad when compared to n log n. Quadratic behavior, also known as order n squared, essentially double loop behavior. You have two loops, one inside the other. The inner loop executes n times. The outer loop executes n times. So the total number of iterations is n squared. And you notice that this is pretty bad. Now we're sort of edging off into useful algorithms. We are edging into algorithms that don't perform very well. N squared is at the edge. You have an n squared algorithm, you should probably work hard to reduce the complexity of that algorithm to something that we talked about earlier, n log n or linear. Cubic is essentially, if n squared is doubly nested loops, what's cubic? Triply nested loops, exactly, for the same reason. Right? So now I have two loops, one inside the other. That's n squared behavior. Now I put that in a loop that also does n. So now I'm doing n squared n times, that's n cubed. And it goes on like that, right? If I have four nested loops, five nested loops, so forth and so on. And as I mentioned, matrix multiplication is the canonical n cubed algorithm. And notice what it does to n squared. Right? N squared is a pretty nasty algorithm compared to what we've discussed earlier, but it doesn't look that bad when you compare it to n cubed. Notice that we've changed the scale of the x-axis or the n-axis here. Right? This is up to 1,000. This is up to 7 or 8, sorry, not 7, but 8 or 9. So you don't have to go too far out in order to get an extremely large value. Exponential behavior, this is the worst possible behavior that we're going to look at. There are actually some other ones. This is essentially systematic guessing. You're supposed to find the solution to a problem. The way you do that is you just guess at a solution and check it. If it works, you're done. If it doesn't work, you guess again. We are not going to look at exponential algorithms in this class. Unfortunately, they're actually kind of interesting, but we're not going to do it. All right, and that's essentially the family portrait of what we are going to be dealing with, except for the cubics. We're not going to go much above n-squared algorithms. So here is another way to look at these estimates. I've shown you pictures, but the important another way to understand these is to look at numbers. So if we fix a value of n and then look at the various levels, constant, logarithmic, linear, log linear. Oh, I see. This is too small. This is log linear. This is n squared, n cubed, and 2 to the n. Again, if it's a constant, then it doesn't matter what n is. The value is going to be c, so it's independent of n. If this is log, this is 4.6. These are essentially, what are these? These, well, what's the base of this logarithm? Doesn't matter. Well, no, if it was 10, what would this be? What is log base 10 of 100? 2, right. So it's not 10. Well, what's log base 10 of 2? Sorry, log base 2 of 100. 8-ish. Why would you say that? Exactly. So you give me the n. Well, actually, probably n is a misleading since people think that's integer. Say 2 to the x. Right.